You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Brad Loncar, Mike Yee, Yaron Werber, and guest host Nick Shipley, the Chief Advocacy Officer at Bio. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. This week, the Federal Reserve announced its plans to cut interest rates. This, coupled with continued M&A and other dynamics, have contributed to a rally in the XBI, which started in early November. And XBI was up 20% this week, has now regained all the losses from the year pretty much. Mike, what are your thoughts on XBI and a potential turnaround in biotech sentiment?
Hey, great. Well, it feels good, right? I guess a couple of thoughts. One is, it goes back to what we've been emphasizing, and I think which has been talked about on Hangout and may be surprising for biotech specialists, is that rates have a profound impact despite all the science and biotechnology we have. It's quite amazing how much rates and the Fed commentary has on stock performance, and we've been saying that that's at least half of the problem this year. And I know Brad and Tim and others have commented on that. So you can see that even with the slight change of things and some light at the end of the tunnel, how quickly things can move. The second point I would say, and I'd love to have others chime in on, is we believe that a good portion of the early moves is probably a lot of short covering. I think that that is particularly evident because the biggest moves were the ones where there was significant short interest, a lot of the gene editing names, et cetera, et cetera. So that I think would point you to that. And one of the questions that I think would help us understand if this is going to be sustainable is whether mutual funds and broader folks come in. We would just say to wrap up that I do think that there might be some FOMO sense that maybe if this continues, it can keep going because there's always a FOMO aspect to things. And secondly is I personally believe there'll be a bit of a pullback going into JP Morgan. That's my call. But overall, the course of the year, since rates are going to be coming down by at least 100 bips consensus, that I think that the sector should continue to repair. I think we've been talking about that.
I'll just jump in and say, I also think we should keep this in context. Like, I'll be kind of like devil's advocate and negative here, which is that, you know, the other, with all of this Fed news, the rest of the stock market is reaching all-time highs. Like the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 is reaching all-time highs, and we're 50% below our highs. And that speaks to a lot of the things that Nick is going to talk about in a minute, like all of the government interference and all of the negative headlines as far as that goes. So, like, obviously we all want stocks to go up, and it's great that we finally have some kind of a bounce for the first time in a couple of years. But I think us relative to like other industries and other sectors and like the broader stock market, it's worth remembering that like interest rates are only a component of what have been holding us down, and maybe a small component, you know, because of how transformational some of these other issues could be. So I think it's like, if people are just thinking like once interest rates start going down again or whatever, like that'll solve all of our problems and biotech will be, you know, rock and roll again. Like that's, I think that's definitely short-sighted, and that's, you know, seen in where we are relative to our all-time high versus the rest of the stock market.
You know, one of the things that we've talked a lot is biotech's never been down 3 years in a row, and we were sadly tracking to break that record this year. We're now actually flat on the year. Now, you know, Mike, I tend to agree with you. If you kind of look at, and I tend to agree with you, Brad, that we're all-time high. And Mike, you mentioning you're expecting maybe a pullback. If you look at all the indices right now, they're all RSI more than 70. They're all overbought. So we are due for a correction. whether it's going to happen into the end of this year, you know, a little bit, or into early next year remains to be seen. But, you know, it looks like we're moving toward a kind of a soft landing. And look, Brett, I do hear you that the fundamentals in biotech aren't quite as good as they were, let's say, 2 years ago. But at the same time, valuations still are 40% below the peak. And let's not even look at the indices, right? Because maybe it's not accurately reflecting what's really going on in the sector, where we have a lot of small caps trading at half cash. You know, so you can, I think things are even now still very much grossly overcorrected. And I'm a lot more constructive. I do think valuations are already sort of underpinning some of the headwinds.
I'm fairly constructive. I think it has to do with fund flows and money. When mutual funds say we own 100 bips in a book and maybe we should own 200 bips, 100 bips on 40 billion moves small caps. So I think that when portfolio positioning does things, stocks can move up, and that's part of it.
Yeah, when generalists begin to call Mike and me, you know the sector is going to move.
We just want a stock that has an approved drug and no binary risk, Yaron. Just give me a stock with the approved drug and no binary risk. Doesn't matter.
But do you want an approved drug that actually has good fundamentals or just approved drug?
Well, this is, I think, a really good time to segue into some of the headwinds that have faced the industry from government and increasing pressure on drug pricing. One person who is on the forefront of these issues, really advocating on behalf of our industry, is Nick Shipley. Nick, the Biden administration caused some concern last week when they made strong statements about their plans to exercise margin rights on patents. And Biden actually highlighted drug pricing specifically, even though it sounds like this initiative is broader than drug specific. From talking with you and other policy experts, this sounds like it's less alarming than one would initially think. What are your thoughts on how real the threat is and the implications if it actually gets through?
Yeah, there's a lot going on here that I think your first instinct is correct. There's probably a lot more hype than substance to this specific policy release. At the end of the day, you know, what Biden announced was nothing that changed the law. It was simply a kind of a use of the presidential bully pulpit to announce a framework that they want to consider price as a factor in future margin petitions. That is very different than changing the actual law around margin on Bayh-Dole patents. So I do think you are correct to note that there's probably not as much, you know, immediate real-term impact from this. But I do think it points to a couple things that will be, you know, headwinds, one which is that we continue to battle this kind of narrative that floats around that the NIH does all the work, you know, they're the ones who invest in everything. And it kind of is a narrative that boxes out all the effort and all the investment that the private sector, that this audience, quite frankly, makes in these products. And whether it was Mike or Brad made reference to the amount of risk that's out there, a risk-free product. I don't know that anyone's ever found that quite yet. But I think that's the part that gets diminished when that narrative kind of floats around. I also think what we've seen with the Marchin announcement and a couple other announcements that followed in short order is the kind of affirmation that politically speaking, beating up on the industry is what most candidates consider good politics. And we are heading into an election year. We are going to see a lot of this type of announcement where they talk about fighting the industry, beating up on the industry. There was a subsequent announcement later in the week where, you know, served as kind of a glorified press release for the Inflation Reduction Act again, even though that's over a year old now. But I think we're going to see a lot of that in 2024 because they clearly believe that it polls well and it will help them win.
Yeah, and when we talk about the industry and fundamentals, obviously M&A is a huge driver and would be a huge driver of any really sustainable rally in biotech. I was concerned to see FTC pushing back on the Sanofi and Maze Therapeutics proposed license agreement this week. This seemed like a huge overreach and also made no sense, as this is a rare disease with dozens of drugs in development. What was FTC thinking here?
I mean, I'm with you. This was a big overreach. I think we've had long concerns about FTC's increasing efforts to step into the biopharmaceutical space. We saw it earlier in the year with Amgen Horizon. This move was unprecedented in that how early it was in the pipeline. You know, this was a phase one therapy, pretty far from guaranteed on FDA approval, and it was a licensing deal. It wasn't even a merger. So I think it was very new to see FTC exercise that authority, and a little bit worrisome, quite frankly. They've got a couple processes, very kind of technical processes on the regulatory front on reviewing their merger guidelines. But I think what we're really seeing is just this, the outgrowth of a very, very much Chairwoman Lina Khan's philosophy that mergers are bad, and FTC's job is to step in and block these things. Now they've been doing this across a lot of industries. We've seen it in tech, you know, as well. They actually have a pretty poor track record for these things when they get to court, which, you know, they tried to push the Amgen Horizon one to that level and eventually kind of abandon it because it was pretty clear they were pushing some pretty novel and untested legal theories in that case. I think what's worrisome here, especially in this is a rare disease space, is at some point they can intervene in these early stage deals, and the economics just aren't there to fight it in court. Like I mean, this is, we're talking about in this case a rare disease that has something with, you know, like, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 patients globally, worldwide. You know, there's just not going to be an economic case to say, hey, I want to fight this in court for a year, to justify that. And I sympathize, it's terrible, but I do kind of get the economics are just stacked against you, and it's a real bummer that the FTC is then going to look at that and be like, and count that as a win, because they blocked this. And I don't want to speak for the individual, you know, kind of companies involved. They've got, you know, the decisions they've got to make there. But I really do hope that, you know, Maze Therapeutics can continue to develop this, can, you know, find a partner and cash flow as needed, because this has potential to be really detrimental. So I do worry a lot about the FTC piece. I actually think it has more potential to have more real world impact than the Marchin piece, even though that got all the headlines.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point that, you know, FTC backed off of the much larger Amgen Horizon suit, and then, you know, we saw Pfizer confirm that it expects to close its $43 billion Seagen deal after getting all the regulatory approvals. So I thought it was interesting that Sanofi walked away from the deal so quickly. It's a good point that you know, maybe it wasn't worth it, but companies could try to push through some of these FTC challenges, and you know, we'll see how that plays out. You know, Nick, when I met with lawmakers in D.C. with you and colleagues from Bio, it struck me that there was a lot more bipartisan support for initiatives that are industry friendly than I had expected. And sort of picking up on this rare disease area, the Orphan Cures Act, you know, could you say a little bit more about that? And also the Lower Cost, More Transparency Act, which I guess had some great progress this week. Can you talk about those?
Yeah. And one, I should kind of say thank you, one, for participating in our fly-in and coming to DC. I always encourage this community, this industry, to be active, to stay involved with DC. It's really easy to kind of ignore Washington DC and say, oh, that doesn't affect us. But as an industry, we're intertwined with policymakers, you know, through on the payer side with Medicare, Medicaid, the ACA plans, on the approval process with FDA. So I think we as an industry owe it to ourselves to make sure we are advocating on our behalf, because elected officials were, you know, fundamentally not experts in this field. They are not educated. They don't know it. They don't have the experience that you guys have in this way. You know, yesterday they were a sheriff, they were a lawyer, they were a real estate agent. You know, they win an election, and now suddenly they're in charge of voting on how Medicare is going to cover therapies for 90 million beneficiaries. So it is super important to stay involved like that. The two pieces you mentioned, the Orphan Cures Act, is a great example that there is still bipartisan support to kind of have innovation incentives. This legislation is a fix to some damage done to the Orphan Drug Act by the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. It really crammed down on a lot of long established incentives to get people to invest in orphan drugs, in rare disease. The Orphan Cures Act would restore some of those incentives, allowing orphan drugs to be exempt from the IRA's price controls, which is a very big deal, and also affects when the negotiation clock, if you will start running. Right now, if you have an orphan drug, whether you have an orphan drug or not, the minute you get FDA approval, your negotiation shot clock is starts ticking down. This bill would say, hey, you don't start running the clock until after you get beyond the orphan drug approval. You move into bigger indications, and then it's kind of fair game. Those policies did get bipartisan support in the House and Senate. We are in the process of building even bigger support, because the way you move things from just an introduced bill to a bill that passes is you get co-sponsors to get on there. So I do encourage everyone to reach out to your local members and highlight this for them and push this, because I do think it's a big deal. We have, you know, something like 7,000 rare diseases out there, and around 90% of them do not have a treatment at all. 50% of that is in the pediatric class. So it's an intense need. And I think it does have support on the Hill, as you noted. The other piece you mentioned, the Lower Cost, More Transparency Act. This is a PBM reform bill. This is one that is part of that exact process. It's moved all the way to passage in the House. We have the Senate hasn't done floor consideration of their bill yet, their version of it, but they have done committee consideration. So it's moving along. These things are usually, you know, take a little while. Legislation is not fast, but they have things like PBM transparency, delinking of the price from what the PBMs charge, a lot of kind of benefit design pieces and rebate pass through. Those are all the type of policies that are being discussed in here. There's also some pretty under-discussed but equally important transparency around things like hospitals and insurance companies and labs, and about how their charge master prices work, which has a lot of impact on the industry. I do think it probably doesn't get appreciated enough that this industry is one of the few points where patients have that direct exposure to the cost, and that leads to a lot of frustration by them that I empathize with. You know, you go into the hospital and you don't see the markup that they are charging on therapies. You just get a giant incomprehensible 20-page bill, you know, 2 weeks later after you've been in there. So I do think it's going to be really helpful and really important to have more transparency on that part of the process as well. We as an industry have been dealing with a lot of increased transparency over the last decade at the state level, at the federal level. So I think it all is going to be to the good as we move that forward.
Yeah. And I think that it's good when we start getting pushback on PBMs and other middlemen, because I think there's another focus for some of these sound bites other than the pharma and biotech industry. So actually, on a related note to the Orphan Cures Act, one other obviously big issue in the IRA is the small molecule 9-year issue. Is there any progress on that you can speak to?
I think there is. This has been a big priority for our organization, for Bio. We've been working on it pretty much, you know, ever since the bill passed. But it's a big fix. It's not something that is easy. I think a lot of getting fixes to these bills that are so kind of hard fought. This was a very politically charged process. And you've got to convince one party that fought to get this passed that their bill's not perfect and it needs to be amended, it needs to be fixed. It's really hard, just human nature, for those policymakers to admit maybe they didn't get it right on the first try. And I think this is the challenge we're having is we're just convincing them that there is real damage here by lowering the floor on the small market molecules so much. And we, I do think, are having some good conversations, and I'm still very hopeful that we will get bipartisan legislation to address that fix in the near term. I don't want to go too far out, far on a limb. We have at least some pretty active discussions going on, but I'm still hoping for good news on that front, because I do think it's something that a lot of members, as we've explained it and educated them, have begun to understand the kind of damage that was done.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Nick. I'll open up to the group before we move on to other topics, see if anybody has any questions or comments on some of these policy issues.
I have a go ahead, Mike.
Well, I think I heard him mention IRA and all of this negotiation stuff. One of the things I was thinking about is I think by February 1st, we're supposed to hear about the actual first round of negotiations. And I was wondering if anybody has any view about what's going to happen, what they're hearing, or whether that's going to impact anything. And if that's even on anyone's radar, February 1st.
I mean, I think it's definitely on people's radar. Implementation of this, yep. And I want to be careful about speaking for the companies that are named, that are in this process. They are also, they're in active negotiation with CMS. They're also, I think, all in active litigation with CMS simultaneously. So there are a lot of pieces moving on this. But I think one of the things that is pretty, you know, kind of continues to amaze me as people talk about IRA and the bill is this, it's just fundamentally not a negotiation. They literally did put the price formula in the bill. It's in statute. You can make a pretty, you know, aggressive calculation based on that. The negotiation is, quite honestly, if CMS wants to demand even more cost concessions out of the companies, and the penalty for kind of quote unquote walking away is so draconian that it's kind of not possible. And that's the crux of a lot of the litigation there. But I think this is all, it's very much on the radars of those companies that got dinged. We hear about it quite a bit, and there's a lot of implementation questions that are still kind of swirling on that front as well.
Yeah. Nick, I have a provocative question to ask, and I'll preface this by saying, this isn't a political question or statement, although everyone's going to take it that way. It's clear to me that these issues are only going to get worse as long as President Biden is the president. Like, this is not election talk from him. This is his administration's philosophy in business and how it relates to our industry. Specifically, like, if he could wave a magic wand to like cut the size of our industry in half, he would do it. Like, that is how he feels about our industry. And all of these things, march-in rights, the Medicare negotiations and wanting to expand that and all of that, you know, all flow down from that philosophy. So if we were being like rational business people, as an industry, wouldn't we support whoever his challenger is? And I saw an Endpoints survey a week ago where they interviewed 100 of the, you know, CEOs in biotech, and 86% said that they were going to vote for President Biden in the next election. And so I'm reading that and just thinking, like, aren't we doomed as an industry if 86% of our top leaders are going to support the person who is arguably like the worst, you know, administration ever for the future of our industry? What do you think about that?
I totally get what you're saying about how this will come across as kind of overtly partisan. But a lot of what you're saying is accurate. And, I'll kind of expound on a little bit. Like, there's no doubt that Biden and the view that the administration, his staff has taken, has been very anti-industry. And I don't think it's purely just about scoring some political points for re-election. There are policies they fought very hard for. IRA is the big, you know, legacy item there, that have been a part of, or they've been things that Biden has believed in and worked for since he was a senator. He has a very long track record of public service, the Senate, VP, now president. So I don't think that should be a shock to anyone. A couple things I would add on that maybe would caveat it. You know, elections are always choices, right? There's if I don't vote for this guy, am I voting for the other guy? And I say that because it looks increasingly like it is going to be the other guy and a rematch of what we had last time. And that other guy is not particularly great for industry either. It is, I think, a real kind of nadir for our industry in terms of how policymakers view us. And I think that is why I do double down to the need to engage. And I think the industry gets kind of a little bit of a bad rep that's out there, because it's just this idea that, well, you'll just keep innovating, nothing will change, and we can kind of ding you guys all day long, and that's, I think, something that we've just gotta we gotta do a better job about explaining the risks and what's going on there. And I really, you know, the presidential election, you know, the office of the president is responsible for so much more. I'm going to give a slight pass to those 86% of CEOs in endpoints, because I, you know, you never know what they're basing that election on. Where I start to get less forgiving, if you will, is quite honestly where we have some of the highest concentrations of our of biotech jobs. And they, like you said, consistently still vote at local levels, where it's much more immediate. They vote for policymakers who would, like you said, wipe us out. You know, they would, I don't want to name names, but the Massachusetts delegation is pretty brutal in its views of our industry, despite the role that this industry played in the revitalization of Cambridge and that whole area.
I agree with you. I'll name names. I mean, Elizabeth Warren does not think our industry should be a for-profit industry. And I'm guessing she got 86% of the vote, too. And again, I really don't mean this as a political statement. I mean, it is like, you know, talking about being rational. Like, we're supporting the people that are working to put us out of business. And as long as you do that, you're eventually going to be out of business. So there's... It seems like a futile problem and a sign that this is going to be a slippery slope that gets worse, because nothing will be done about it.
Yeah. Sorry, Daphne, just to maybe finish the thought there. Like, I think the one assumption I don't want anyone to walk away with is that the politicians themselves are acting irrationally here. If they take these positions and make these votes, and then they win with 86% of their constituents voting for them, they're going to keep doing it. That is kind of the flip side to that coin. So it's like, all right, if we want them to kind of listen and make a difference, we have to figure out what that means. And the most obvious thing is in the voting. It is holding them accountable, for the policy positions that they choose to take. And again, everyone's got to make their own vote, and there's a lot of different issues and factors that go into it. But right now, it is no doubt that in a large portion of our biotech hubs in the U.S., there is a cognitive disconnect between the policy positions and the constituents and the jobs that they represent.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that bothers me is I see a lot of people talking about it. You know, we're talking amongst ourselves, but the way to have an impact is to make sure that these lawmakers know how important it is, the case for new medicines, and also supporting specific initiatives that aim to address problems with the IRA. And on that front, I feel pretty optimistic that there is the potential for bipartisan support, And also, you know, there's another bad guy out there that might attract some more interest, and that's, you know, the PBMs. And there's a number of different things going on that are sort of anti-PBM. So it's not all about our industry. So I think, you know, we'll share some resources about actual steps that we can take, but it's really important to let your own representatives know, and to also let your, you know, your company, you know, broader employment base, I know that these are important issues to push back on. So, Nick, any other remarks before we move to some other topics? And feel free to jump in on other topics as well.
No, I really appreciate it. I think if I was going to mention any other issue, it's one that I think is near and dear to your heart as well, Daphne, which is we have seen some very positive talks and discussions on the R&D amortization piece of the tax package, and there is a very good chance we see some movement there in the beginning of 2024. I know that's a big deal for a lot of people in our industry, not just our industry, but any industry that is R&D intense. But this industry is notoriously the highest R&D spend out there, and so I do want to put that on people's radar and your radar that we feel cautiously optimistic about where that stands, and just kind of reflects again that there is still the possibility and the potential to get, you know, good bipartisan, you know, legislation done.
Yeah, thank you for that. So we will share some resources through the Biotech Hangout Twitter feed. So Bluebird had a landmark FDA gene therapy approval in sickle cell disease, but the announcement of pricing coincided with CRISPR and Vertex's sickle cell therapy and approval. The box warning for Bluebird and also loss of the pediatric voucher all came around the same time. Brad, I saw you commenting on some of the mistakes that were made and would love to walk through them and also get your thoughts on what they could have done differently. And then you'll run to comment as well.
Yeah, I mean, my opinion, the mistake that was made is, I mean, they're the smaller competitor. They're hanging on by a thread here. And I think that they rushed out their decision on pricing. So their PDUFA date was originally like a week after Vertex's, and I think it would have done them a lot of good to see what Vertex did and, you know, be very thoughtful about what their pricing was. So theirs is $3.1 million and Vertex's is $2.2 million. And, you know, at a minimum on a day like that, if you expect the approval on the same day, which, you know, I'm sure they had an idea that was happening, at a minimum, I think you have like an emergency board meeting or something and just like, you know, give it a couple hours. You don't, you know, because, you know, for to have a price that's almost $1 million above your, you know, very well-funded, strong competitor, I think puts them in a very precarious position. And the big thing with Bluebird is as of the last quarter, they have $227 million cash on hand. And they announced that that will get them through the second quarter of next year, which, I mean, we're talking 6 months. So that doesn't give them a lot of time to be able to show that they're able to launch this and turn it into a robust business. Now, they did have like an interesting 8K yesterday where they said that they've signed an agreement with a payer who covers 100 million lives in the U.S. And they, one thing that was like, I thought super interesting about it that I didn't see a lot of people talking about is they said it was an outcomes based agreement. So normally that means like, you know, a refund if the durability isn't there for, you know, a patient years later or something's. And that's not something they've talked a lot about in the context of sickle cell disease before. And I don't believe Vertex is doing outcomes based selling. So it'll be interesting to follow this and see exactly what that means and if they provide any more color on it than just what was in the 8K.
Two questions. One is, I would love to know if you guys have an opinion about how that works. I'm not on a board, but maybe Daphne has a view. I mean, they knew this was happening. Nobody said you had to come out with the price on the same day. I know many companies that don't have the price that right away. So how did that happen?
And wouldn't you have wanted to wait to hear the price? And then secondly, Vertex does not have outcomes because I spoke with Vertex. I cover Vertex and we'll move on to Vertex shortly. But the drug obviously works in like 99% of people and it's huge outcomes. So they don't expect, and it basically works for everybody for a long time. So there's no outcomes on that.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, I think that I was surprised as well, to your point and Brad's point, that they kind of rushed to have that information out there. I do think that that was the wrong decision. They could have, you know, taken in the information and made, made a better informed decision by waiting a little bit. So I totally agree with that.
And the label. Right. They knew that the label was going to have a black box. And I'm not saying that that necessarily was also the driver of the stock reaction, too. But the combination of both of those things was an issue.
And another thing for everyone to think about over the long term as this plays out, like the context that I think is super interesting is, as everyone knows, these companies both have been planning for this for a long time, like literally years, and especially over the last, you know, year to 6 months, they've both been having, you know, constant meetings with payers. And if you, before this news came out and before the black box especially was out there, but I think it's still fair to say this today, that most experts view the profile of these drugs as either the same or very similar. So I think it's interesting that two companies with drugs that are of the same profile have been having meetings with payer, you know, the payers who are the same people for an entire year. And one company came out of those meetings thinking that the right price was, you know, $3.1 million, and another one came out thinking that it was $2.2 million. And so what that tells you is that either Bluebird went way above, you know, what was discussed in those meetings, or Vertex came out way below what was discussed in those meetings. And I don't know which one of the two it is, like maybe it's a mixture, but like it would be super fascinating to know that, because there's, you know, some really interesting underlying strategy going on between these two companies. And so it's going to be fascinating to see if like the like we'll ever be able to put together the pieces of which of those two scenarios is really at play here.
So I cover Blue, and so, you know, one of the things is a couple of things historically to remember. That number one, in Europe they launched, remember, is Zynteglo. It was actually approved for sickle cell originally in Europe. The price was going to be about 2.6, 2.7 million or so. And that they announced, and of course they couldn't even get alignment with Germany. Germany, I think, wanted to reimburse at 800K. But if you recall, ICER, and please correct me, I could be off, but I remember I thought ICER was supportive of that price, which was going to be a global price. So I'm almost kind of thinking Vertex, you might be appropriately underpricing here. Now, secondly, most of the market, 80% is Medicaid, right? Where there you have sort of mandatory pre-negotiated discounts. And of course, I agree with you. It's a 3-year outcomes-based, value-based agreements, but of course, everybody essentially responds. So these are going to be just a little bit more academic in nature and probably wouldn't really lead to any discounts. I think the bigger elephant in the room is what's the actual demand and pull-through going to be, given that the label is only 12-year-olds and above. And of course, these sorts of therapies are better geared to even giving it to the ultra-pediatrics who are younger in life. And we all know that demand's probably going to be fairly soft. So it's interesting that they're coming out and they're already saying that they're actually beginning to put these agreements in place. So again, I'm not defending the price. I'm actually thinking at the end, it's not going to be in their favor at the end that they're 900 grand too high. I frankly do think demand's going to be fairly weak, probably for both products. But then they also came out and they said they're expecting 85 to 105 collections next year across their three drugs, which is frankly double of kind of what we are in our model. So it does seem like there's some optimism there overall. And then finally, you know, they need to raise about $1 billion according to our model over the next 4 years. So it's a daunting task just given their high fixed costs.
Yeah, tough times for Bluebird. Well, Vertex had two other big news items this week. Mike, Vertex announced positive results from phase 2 study in diabetic neuropathy. What were your thoughts on the efficacy vis-a-vis Lyrica and the stock price reaction?
Yeah, so in some refreshing, super good news in large cap and across the sector, so I think we should applaud that. We had Vertex come out with positive, quote-unquote, statistically significant data in diabetic peripheral neuropathy, i.e. chronic neuropathic pain indication, where all three of the doses, quote-unquote, and you'll hear me say quote-unquote, had a statistically significant improvement in the pain score of around 2 points from baseline after 12 weeks. And that result was positive, statistically significant. The key was that the drugs did show improvement in pain, but also that the active comparator arm of Lyrica also showed around a 2-point improvement, so that folks can see that the drug looks similarly effective to the what was a $5 to $7 billion drug in Lyrica. So that is a positive because looks like they've got a pain drug in a huge indication. Of where we could have a long debate about, obviously, the great attractiveness of a non-opioid oral pill for chronic neuropathic pain, which is obviously a huge problem. So this could be a great solution for this long term. There's also some interesting legislation called the No Pain Act, which y'all could look into around how the government actually is providing potential reimbursement for folks to push for non-opioid pain drugs, and that therefore there is a good infrastructure here to support a multi-billion dollar pain drug. Now, I would caveat by saying, funny enough, typical Wall Street, a couple weeks ago, there was a lot of controversy, and I would agree that there is still some debate around the fact that there was no placebo arm in this study. So we could have a nice discussion about that, but basically there were three arms, low, medium, high dose. And Lyrica, everybody goes down by about 2 points on a 0 to 10 scale, and that was great. Although everybody was on something, and I guess if you looked at the protocol design and you're in the study, you knew you were not getting a placebo. But the result is good. It looks good. And there are also two phase 3 acute studies coming out in January, and we do think those should be positive as well, and they're going to file to the FDA. So the bottom line, Daphne, was it looks good. Definitely a very positive outcome for a phase 2, and they're pushing forward to phase 3, and it looks good. And I'm happy to see that. So it was great.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mike. And Vertex had another deal this week, or another news item this week, with announcing a licensing deal with Editas for the CRISPR-Cas9. I guess it was non-exclusive. Brad, any thoughts on the deal and implications for Editas and also for other CRISPR companies?
Yeah, so, you know, this whole patent fight has been in the news for many, many years. So Editas, the science behind that is the Broad, Feng Zhang, and Vertex, which is their partner's CRISPR, that's Emmanuel Charpentier, and then Intellia is Jennifer Doudna at UC Berkeley. And, you know, since we ever heard of CRISPR-Cas9, all these, you know, people have been filing their patents and suing each other. And Editas, the Broad, won a big victory from the U.S. Patent Office about a year and a half ago. And the outlook was for this to, you know, continue to be battled out in the courts, you know, over the coming years. But instead, Vertex has made a $100 million payment today. Actually, I think 50 of it is immediately available, and 50 of it is going to be soon, and then another 50 based off of, you know, sales or other milestones. But it's a good thing because it just, like, there's no this. I don't think it would have been to begin with, but if there was ever a cloud kind of hanging over the launch of this for Vertex, that was it. So this puts this to bed. And the importance of it really is for Editas. You know, Editas has been very slow to develop things and could use, you know, they're in danger of becoming like a bluebird, you know, being at the forefront of interesting technologies like this, but you know, taking so long that funding becomes an issue. So any additional non-dilutive capital they can get is a big thing for them. And the last thing I would say about this is, you know, as an investor, I always ignored like these types of patent headlines. Like this happens with so many technologies. Like it happened with CAR T, where like all the CAR T companies early on were suing each other. And these always like take up a lot of news headlines and debate, and people talk about them and tweets and everything. And then almost always what happens years and years later is something like this. Like $150 million sounds like a lot of money, but it's not for Vertex. I mean, they have $13.9 billion. And so like these things always like start with a roar and like end with a whimper. And so the next time there's some new technology and all, you know, early on, all everyone's talking about is lawsuits, I would just say that probably the same thing will happen to that too. So it usually turns out to be, you know, mostly about nothing.
Yeah, I think I remember when some of these lawsuits and they were in the news, and you said that at the time, and you were right. We'll come back at the end to predictions for next year, because you always have some really interesting predictions. There were a few M&A deals this week. I think we should go through those really quickly so we have time to talk about ASH. There was AstraZeneca, Icosavax, $1.1 billion. Did you want to say anything about that, Brad, or should I just quickly go through the ADC deals?
Yeah, I'll be quick on that. I think it's an interesting deal. You know, the RSV vaccine launches by Glaxo and Pfizer are going really well. Like Glaxo, I think, is guiding for like $1.2 billion over a year. That's really strong. And what a lot of people don't know about those is the efficacy of them wanes really quickly, and they can't really be boosted. So I think that the initial efficacy is like 80%, and that drops to like 30% by like the second year. And like boosting doesn't do a lot. So this is a great example of like a new market that's proving to be commercially attractive with products that, you know, maybe aren't the best. So this company, Icosavax, has like a protein virus like particle platform. And so, you know, I think AstraZeneca sees an opening to maybe, even though they'll be a lot later, to come in with something that might have a better profile. And in the meantime, Glaxo and Pfizer will have already, you know, proven the commercial viability of this market in practice.
Yeah. And speaking of vaccines, Mike, shares of Pfizer have fallen nearly 50% this year, which wouldn't be unusual for a mid-cap company, but that for Pfizer translates to, I think, like $150 billion in value, wiping out a lot of its success. I think all of it's back to like pre-pandemic levels. So what's your take on that?
Well, I'll make a few comments. First is that, obviously, the sales of the COVID vaccine, as well as Paxlovid, have obviously been essentially, down 75% from the peak. And so that was a huge problem. And the overall visibility of where that was going has been waning every year that we have come out of the pandemic. And for 2024, the company guided to significantly below where consensus was on COVID vaccines and Paxlovid, as well as some other margin questions. So total EPS was way below, but overall a big part of that was also the vaccine stuff. And that's obviously a huge part of the change in valuation. And then the second, mind you, the pipeline disappointments from the obesity angle, which was a big part of what was going on there. And it was a big focus of the last earnings call as well. And so that was a big disappointment. The stock fell a bunch on that. And they've had a bunch of other pipeline disappointments. Side note, you know, we could probably all sort of raise our eyebrows on the fact that in biotech, you know, Daphne, do you realize that the TL1A that Roivant got obviously was from Pfizer?
Yep.
And was sold for $7 billion months later. And Cerevel. And then Cerevel just happened. I mean, that was all a spin out. And that just got sold for $7 billion. So, like, what's going on there? So without, you know, kicking someone too hard while they're down, I think the point is that it's reflective of a lot of the COVID situation that has waned off. And obviously you could probably overlap that with the Moderna chart as well. And you can see that as well too. And so Moderna is going through their own challenges as they try to turn that around to find the next growth driver. So it's actually a little bit of the same story, to be fair.
Can I just chime in for maybe 1 second on the last point on Pfizer? And you know, we spent 4 years in industry and worked closely at Pfizer at the time on some of the products that they had internally that they decided they didn't want to advance, but they didn't want to just completely just kind of out-license them outright for $5 million and take them and go away. And so they've done these sort of joint ventures. So, you know, I think from a Pfizer viewpoint, I don't want to speak to them, but from a BD viewpoint in the industry, yeah, you can say Pfizer don't look very good. I would argue, though, that these are products that they decided not to ultimately advance themselves, and they benefited dramatically from both of those sales, either by the 25% ownership in the TL1A or from their stake in Cerevel. And so, you know, there is a middle-of-the-road approach, which I think does lead to a win-win, because not in every case you can just, you know, Cerevel wasn't worth $7 billion, you know, 5 years ago. We were actually looking at it and, frankly, bidding for it when I was on the other side at that point. So, you know, I would argue we shouldn't just penalize Pfizer is what I'm trying to say.
I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. I think it was more that the street, I'll just go from the Wall Street perspective, saw, two significant assets that are supposed to be blockbusters, right? Huge blockbusters per Merck and AbbVie, who are making that claim, and contrasting that with the fact that Pfizer needs drugs, I think it was just happened to be in the same situation at the same time. So, I don't think anyone's being too critical because it's a tough business, but that those two things happened really quickly.
For sure. And I think we could have a whole discussion, and we should do that, about products that were initially advanced by pharma companies and then biotechs took them forward and created value. And like, just how should they be thinking about deal making around those? So quickly on ADC, obviously the ADC space has been really hot. A few deals this week, BMS and SystImmune partnered on a phase one ADC targeting EGFR and HER3 with $800 million upfront, $7.6 billion biobucks. And for BMS, this is the third ADC deal this year. And HER3 ADCs specifically are also heating up. You might remember that Merck acquired a HER3 ADC as part of its $4 billion upfront multi-product licensing deal with Daiichi in October. Another ADC deal this week was from C4 Therapeutics and Merck. This one originally stood out to me because it was a little bit weird. It was a $2.5 billion biobucks deal, but the upfront payment was only $10 million. With that said, very nice validation of the technology, and C4 actually did very well. Their share price rose as much as 360% in the days following the news. So overall, a win-win, and congrats to that team. And then another ADC deal this week, Pfizer licensed a phase one ready ADC from Nona Biosciences for $53 million upfront. This is for solid tumors, and then $1 billion in biobucks. So let's move to ASH. Yaron Arcelix presented additional phase one data at ASH for its BCMA CAR T therapy in multiple myeloma, and would love to hear from you about these data and how they compare with Legend's program.
Yeah, so it's a great question. And you know, Wall Street loves to have a battle, one against the other, and for always, it's boxing. There's always one winner. But in the world, that's not usually the way that works. Sometimes it does, but not always. Arcelix is sort of a fast follower, much lower market cap than Legend. Their new CAR T, which is in phase one now, obviously partnered with Kite Gilead, that was a very reputable, obviously, manufacturer of CAR T. The data is still early, but looks very competitive. Again, comparing cross studies, as we all know, is always tough. And in this case, you can kind of look at the initial Chinese data out of Legend, which looks very differently than the US European data from the pivotal studies. And it does, when you look at the Arcelix data in patients with extramedullary disease or high risk cytogenetics, it does look like they have a better PFS and better response rates. The devil's in the details, though, and I don't want to get into all the nuances here. We're talking about very small subsets of like 11 patients, 12, 13 patients. And also in that study, everybody in the Arcelix study had a PET imaging at baseline, which means that they were able to find any extramedullary disease, even if these patients weren't necessarily all that advanced.
When you compare it to the J&J and Legend studies, they didn't pre-specify PET imaging for EMD testing, and so they relied on sort of historical data, and of course the patients in the database, in their own medical records, who did have EMD positivity. It was typically not just PET, but also biopsy, inevitably, because they were indeed very, very sick and very, very advanced. And so when you compare across studies, of course, they look sicker than, let's say, the average population in the Celex. Of course, we don't have apples to apples data. The bottom line is, I think both of them are very, very good. Gilead is a great manufacturer of drugs, of course, of CAR T. Of course, they didn't make these CAR Ts for the initial phase one. The tech transfer is still underway. They might end up having a shorter vein to vein time. But of course, in the meantime, Legend and J&J are now moving to second line, and they're already substantially enrolled, and they're in at least one of the phase three studies in frontline, and they're going to have 20,000 patients worth of capacity by 2026. And J&J just mentioned the other day that they're essentially believe they'll sell $4.5 billion worth of drug by 2026 or so. So, you know, putting it all together, we think there's plenty of room for both of them. Obviously, huge differences in market cap. And, you know, this battle will continue. The next data from Acelix and Gilead will be sort of late next year, and we'll obviously stay tuned in the meantime.
Thanks. And there was a few other updates from ASH. So, Brad, can you talk about Syndax? And then I think there was some other data around the T-cell engagers. I think you had some stuff you were on as well.
Yeah, so, you know, ASH is always an awesome conference, but for sure this was a down year. Like, there was no, like, blockbuster, you know, data release or anything. In fact, without a doubt, the most exciting piece of data and the thing that everyone talked about the most there was using CD19 CAR in lupus. So, not even hematology, but it was really great data. And, you know, we've talked about CAR Ts for autoimmune diseases a lot over the last year or so. And I mean, it really looks like the real deal. If you saw the before and after pictures of some of the patients on social media, I mean, it's just really incredible. If there was a company that was a headliner, I would argue for sure it was Syndax, because they had not one, but two drugs that were highlights. The first, which was a late breaker that was presented on Tuesday, was their menin inhibitor in a subset of acute leukemia patients that have what's called a KMT2A rearrangement. And the CR rate that they had was 23%, which, to be fair, I think is a little below what Wall Street was looking for. And by the way, these data were all out in October. There was really nothing new at ASH other than some subgroup analyses. But these are patients that truly have, like, you know, sadly failed everything and have, you know, there's really no alternative therapy. So, you know, 23% CR rate actually is pretty good. And they've already started a rolling filing on that. I'm sure it will get approved. And then their second drug, which they're partnered with Incyte on, is a CSFR1R. And if anyone knows this class, you'll know that they were developed pretty widely in cancer for you know, a long time. And it was one of those targets that, like, people had a lot of expectations for. And it didn't really pan out. But in this case, they tested it in chronic GVHD. And data looks really strong. So they and Incyte are filing with that too. And the big question there is, there was a recent approval in chronic GVHD about a year and a half ago. So that was the Cadmon product that Sanofi acquired for about $2 billion, a really big deal. That's a ROCK2 TKI. And and the launch of that has been going really well. So, you know, this was chronic GVHD was a market that was, you know, screaming for new things. You know, before this, pretty much patients only had steroids. And the big question will be, like, how does potentially the Incyte, you know, Syndax drug compete commercially with the ROCK2 inhibitor. So that'll be something that people are following. But big win for them. And, Yeah, bispecifics. You know, right now we're still mostly talking, especially at ASH, about BCMA CD3s and CD20 by CD3s. And the big company that everyone was watching at this year's ASH was Regeneron, because they've really fallen behind. If you had talked about the bispecific space a few years ago, you might have thought that they would be the leader. And a few years later, you know, Roche has a couple CD20s, AbbVie and Genmab, you know, have one, and there's a couple BCMA products on the market too. And so people have always been waiting for Regeneron to really amp up its presence in oncology. And they've had some issues with infections in the past. They've always kind of brushed them aside. But when I talked with Madeline Armstrong, who follows this a lot closer than I do and is a real expert in this space, she seems to think that the infection issue is still not like a totally answered question with some of the Regeneron bispecifics. They filed for one that has like an April PDUFA, so we'll have to see if that's talked about at all. But yeah, overall, just, you know, kind of a, you know, not really a blockbuster year, unfortunately, but always still fun to go to ASH.
Yeah, Ron, did you have any other comments on ASH before we go around and sort of say final remarks?
Yeah, so I'll spend 30 seconds on bispecifics because Brad covered them really well, and specifically on Regeneron. So when you look at Regeneron, they are very late on the DLBCL side. On the follicular side, they actually are looking, they're behind, but reasonably competitive. In DLBCL, the way they got over their infection issue is by splitting the dose, and they require a lot more infusions. We don't think they're going to be that competitive. On BCMA side, actually, they are going to be behind, and they're obviously going to have to duke it out with J&J and obviously Pfizer that's already approved. J&J have both Tecvayli, obviously, and they have Tavle too. And both of those drugs, they're, you know, two different new BCMA and a GPRC5D. They both require REMS, and you could do one REMS program for both, which is a convenience. And obviously, J&J is so dominant. But Regeneron's going to be late, but Linvo. It is competitive, actually. It is IV. The other one's a sub-Q, but it's dosed less frequently. It's got tolerability, actually, has gone better, and it's got a decent response rate. So they're not totally competitive, but competitive enough, and we'll see if they can get an edge. The big one for us more was very early, and it was for Genmab. It's sort of the follow-on to Darzalex. And the bottom line is, remember, they're now running a phase 2 head-to-head. They'll have that data probably ASH next year, and J&J at that point will have an opt-in option. We saw the very early phase 1 data. Bottom line in efficacy, it looked very, very good. But the big issue, and it's very early, by the way, we're talking about 6 out of 11 patients or so, the real issue was the infection rate, the overall toxicity. 2 patients died, not drug-related, though. But there was a lot of discontinuations. Remember, this is a drug that does cause antibody-dependent complement fixation, which Darzalex, of course, didn't have. And so it's supposed to be more effective, but critically, it needs to be very safe. And the safety right now, admittedly, on a small cohort, is a question mark.
Thanks, Johan. So quickly, congrats to our colleague Jay Bradner, who was formerly head of Novartis NIBR and is joining Amgen as its new chief scientific officer. Jay's been on the show a few times. We'll definitely have him back once he's settled in. So to close out today's discussion and the last biotech hangout of the year, we're going to go around and just close out the room. I'm going to ask you all to say if you have any reflections on the industry in 2023. Any thoughts headed into 2024 in JPM? And before I do that, if you plan to be at JPM, we are once again hosting a biotech hangout tweet up event on January 9th at Persona, which is the same location as last year. Open bar, thanks to our sponsors, Johnson & Johnson, Bank of California, FTI Consulting, Point Cross Life Sciences, Mizpro, and PureTech. So check out our biotech hangout Twitter feed for the registration link, and we hope to see you there. Let's go around the room. First of all, thank you, Nick, for joining us today. Do you have any closing thoughts as we head into 2024?
I guess I would just reflect on the listening to you guys on this last piece of the conversation.
And one of the things that just struck me is that there is just this intense level of competition that exists in the industry that I don't think gets appreciated as people talk about some of the kind of big brand names that we've all come to know and love in industry. But I just listened to you guys run through all the different therapies, all the different companies competing, and you know what's happening at ASH, and we'll see it at JPM too, I'm sure. It's a level of competition that I think is underappreciated. It is why I think some of the FTC stuff we talked about earlier kind of is always catches us off guard and sounds so surprising. You know, the administration talks about how there are something like 25 companies in the space that have like 70% of the revenue. And I'm like, that's actually an amazing amount of competition, especially when you compare it to other pieces of the industry, the PBMs that we talked about, that is three companies controlling 80% of all the covered lives. So it's, maybe not apples to apples on the stats there, but it's a pretty staggering amount of consolidation that I wish the FTC would actually look at. So hats off to everyone on the industry that no matter what headwinds the government seems to present, they keep fighting. I think it's very committed to the patients, and it always impresses me. So thank you for having me. This has been great.
And also, Nick, you know, another thing that we were just talking about, the Vertex Bluebird thing, that just goes to show the benefit of like having large financially stable companies in our industry. Like if there's something that's going to save the sickle cell market and make it thrive and really do an amazing thing for a lot of patients, it's going to be the financial heft and stability of Vertex. And so I think that's a great example of how a lot of times politicians, you know, think about this like, you know, completely the opposite of what the reality is.
100%. I had a really good point. And the fact that it's two different companies, two therapies competing, and like the price is going to really impact one of those companies, as you guys were outlining. So really good point.
Anyone else? Closing remarks. This show's gone a little bit longer than planned, but it's okay because it's our last session for the year. We're going to return on January 5th. Anybody have closing remarks before we sign off?
It's Mike. I guess I would just say it is refreshing to have this nice rally, and I don't want to say it's all a bull market. And I think, like Yaron said, we're probably overbought. I do think we're going to have a short-term pullback, so nobody panic on that. But I do think, and maybe it's not some huge prediction to say, I think we'll have a green year next year. I think it will be better. And that is definitely refreshing, Daphne, considering it's been three tough years for everybody here. So looking forward to that as the business continues and everyone goes out and does what we got to do. So that's point one. And point two is I would still say, I know we're all focused on biotech here, but obesity is still the biggest thing going on in pharma, large pharma. And you saw a lot of deals, I know, over the last few weeks. So I'm very keen to see how that plays out because that is much ado on the minds. And you know, I think someone asked me, I guess today, this morning on CNBC about taking the air out of the space because it's all about obesity. But that is still something I'm obviously keenly watching, and there's huge dollars and huge stakes, and including in small cap too, by the way, on that angle. So that's something I'm still very much focused on, and I think a lot of portfolio managers are as well.
Yeah, so I agree with Mike. I think we're in the beginning of the first inning of a recovery that hopefully is going to be now sustainable. I don't think we're going to go into any sort of real bull market here. This is going to be sort of the recovery, right? Like after 2002, right after the bubble burst sort of in the 2000s, but we're going to be in stock picking environment, but valuations are interesting. This is still very much an industry that has inelastic demand, that is very much US based, that is very much, you know, highly efficient and highly innovative. And we're going to start seeing some recovery now in small caps. It's going to start kind of bubbling toward the privates again. We're probably going to start seeing some IPOs next year. It's going to be the traditional sort of recovery play. I think we're going to have to be nimble and selective into what we invest. You can't just buy the index, although the index probably is going to go up too. But I think I'm optimistic for better times ahead. Again, I don't think we're going to go into raging parties, but I think things are going to be healthy from here onwards.
Brad?
I don't really have a strong opinion for biotech next year. I mean, the biggest thing I think that I'm think will happen next year is just our country is going to be on edge with the election. I think that Biden people are going to freak out if it looks like Trump's ahead in the polls late. And I think that Trump people are going to freak out if, you know, when it's the opposite. And, you know, we saw what happened on January 6th and like all the craziness and everything. And I just worry that it could be, especially the second half of the year, like a very volatile, like on edge time for our country. And I hope I'm wrong about that. But I think that's going to be the big news next year.
Yeah. Well, let's hope for good news in 2024 and wish you all a good break and a happy, healthy, and peaceful new year. Thanks to everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Take care.